Earth, fire, air, water. When Avatar Korra invited her old friend Corwin Ravenhair and his family to spend some time with her in Dicho after his wedding to Utrina Tenjo, she had no specific plan in mind, other than to make up some of the time stolen by the scheming of certain White Lotus masters, repair their damaged friendship, and get to know his loved ones. But where Utrina goes, revolution follows. Just not necessarily the kind the masters were afraid of. Sinti U, CUA 16, 291 ASC. Friday, April 16th, Standard Year 2410. MV Mirai, Nanisivik Harbor, Southern Water Tribe, Dicho. Korra woke slowly, and for a few moments she wasn't sure not just where, but who she was. The problem with falling asleep in the spirit world was that you woke up back in the physical one, and it was very disorienting, particularly if you had a lot of past lives you were in regular touch with. She lay for a few moments half-dreaming in an antiquated dialect of Kokugo, until she finished waking the rest of the way up and remembered that she was not, in fact, the Fire Nation avatar before Roku. She turned over, opening her eyes, and found to her momentary surprise that she was on the futon in the solarium. It was still dark outside, not a big surprise. At this time of year, the South Pole lost half an hour or so of daylight a day, so they were down to no more than about 4 hours now. But enough light was seeping through the room's tinted windows from Nanisevic's night glow to make it clear where she was. She could make out the blinking lights on the design desk core across the room, glowing a dull red in sleep mode, and the shadowy shapes of the desks and chairs over in the design office. Yawning, she sat up, the covers pooling around her waist, and composed herself for her morning meditation. It felt a little weird to be doing that in the dark. Though born and raised in the South Pole, she'd spent a lot of her life at lower latitudes. A little smile came to her lips as she remembered the night before, the epic conversation she'd had with Katara, until the lateness of the hour and the warm sunlight of the spirit world beach had at last lulled her to sleep in her lounge chair. Back in the physical world, her body must have crawled under the covers on autopilot, because she didn't remember returning at all before nodding off. 15 minutes of meditation later, she rose from the futon and went below to wash up, put on fresh clothes, and get ready for the day. It was 8:34 in the morning when she sloped into the dining room and found Utrina, Anthy, Maki, and Minami in the middle of breakfast, and Annabelle present, but not dining. "Good morning, Korra," said Anthy with a smile, gesturing to the seat next to her. "We saved you some toast." "Morning," said Korra, taking the place, and the toast. "Where is everybody?" Ryo and the girls had to head out dark and early if they were going to get to Jinbao on time, Minami said, signaling the steward to bring Korra's breakfast. "And Garnet refuses to get out of bed while it's still dark out," Utrina remarked. "I tried to explain to her that it's going to be dark until noon, but she just said, 'More for me, then.'" Korra laughed. "Nice." A moment later, the door from the main companionway opened, and Corwin came in, dressed in his good suit and carrying a small duffel bag. "I'm about ready to head out," he reported. "Any last-minute... Oh, hello." The last was occasioned as Korra, bolting up from the table, all but lunged across the room and seized him in the kind of hug that turned him almost completely around, his duffel bag swinging outward on its strap like a counterweight. "I was hoping I'd see you before you left," she said. "Thank you so much for last night." He grinned. "So you liked your birthday present, then?" he said. "I'm so pleased." "Liked it? It was incredible." She squeezed him again, then let him go and resumed her seat at the table, blushing furiously in response to the knowing little smiles Utna and Anthy were giving her. I just realized what that sounded like, she said lamely. Minami snickered. Then, with an arched eyebrow, she glanced at Utna and asked, When do I get my turn? Behave yourself, Miss Sato, said Utna mock primly. Then she grinned at Korra and gave her near shoulder a friendly thump. I know what you mean. He told us about arranging it last night. I'm glad it went well. Well, ladies, said Corwin cheerfully, I'd better get going. Maki, I probably won't get back until after Kyoshi Island, so I think this is goodbye for now. Don't assume you'll be rid of me that easily, said Maki with a grin, rising to give him a hug of her own. I intend to come up and see this palace of yours once it starts going up. You'll be welcome any time, Corwin assured her. I'll keep you posted. He said his goodbyes to the others, with hugs for all and kisses for his particular ladies. Then he energized the window looking out onto the flight deck, stepped toward it, and vanished. Such a cool trick, Minami said, and then, wistfully, I hope our kids can do that. Utna snorted and went back to work on her breakfast without further comment. I have a message from another time. Airy Productions Unlimited and Magnetic Terrapin Studios present Undocumented Features Future Imperfect, The Legacy of Korra and the Order of the Rose, Suite for Avatar and Trinity, the D-Cho Suite, Fifth Movement, Among Honest Hearts, by Benjamin D. Hutchins, hi, that's me, and Philip Jeremy Moyer, with Anne Cross and Matt Wagner. Sunday, April 18th, Southern Air Temple, Patola Island, Southern Ocean. At this time of year, the Southern Air Temple was bustling. For some parts of the year, it was practically deserted apart from its dedicated staff of air acolyte caretakers and a few elderly airbenders, no longer nomadic, who chose to retire there. But in the southern autumn, most of the nomadic Air Commonwealth population stopped in for a time. While they were there, the temple became the de facto place for airbenders who were not Commonwealth citizens, and either couldn't afford or didn't want to make the trip to the Central Air Temple in Republic City to make contact with the nation. Non-citizen airbenders had never been a problem for the old air nation, of course, the one from before the Hundred Year War. Apart from 3 out of every 4 avatars, there were virtually no airbenders who weren't born air nomads. That was just the way it had worked. All the old nations were like that. Then they were exterminated in the opening stages of the war, and afterward there was just Avatar Aang and his small family, and airbenders teetered on the verge of extinction. By the year 171 after the war began, there were only 4, if you didn't count Aang's successor, Avatar Korra. In that year, though, something strange and wondrous, even by the liberal standards of Dicho, happened, and airbenders began appearing in the world who had no connection at all, genetic or cultural, to the old air nomads or to Aang. Now, 120 years later, the new Air Commonwealth welcomed any and all of those individuals who cared to come to it. Some merely wished to learn how to control their gifts, and had no interest whatever in adopting the ancient and, to be fair, alien culture of the air nomads themselves. Others, for various reasons of their own, were eager to cast off whatever cultures they'd been born into and take up that heritage, comporting themselves in the modern version of the old ways. Sitting on one of the upper balconies of the Air Temple's central tower with her legs dangling over the edge, Lakpa replayed that history lecture in her head as she watched the people milling around in the courtyard. Air acolytes and air nomads, distinguishable by their opposite-colored robes, moved here and there, speaking with ordinarily clothed civilians as they arrived on the backs of sky bison from the docks down at the foot of the mountain. Another 24 had arrived today. Most of the civilians were from the Southern Water Tribe, from the look of them, although she spotted the distinctive garb of a couple of Kyoshi Islanders and some people from the far south of the Earth Kingdom mainland as well. Look at them all, she thought to herself. In any given year, she had once been told, the Commonwealth would get between 200 and 300 of the first type, people who just wanted to be able to go back to their lives without flattening their houses and endangering their families, and 20 or so of the second, the full-on recruits. Not all of the latter would stay, and a handful of the former would decide to, so the final figures worked out roughly the same. Slow but steady growth, and the Commonwealth thrived, no longer dependent on the single, increasingly diffuse pre-war bloodline that traced back to Avatar Aang. For those who belonged to that bloodline, thought Lakpa, the experience was different than a lot of those eager recruits from outside probably thought. She sighed, got to her feet, and went back inside the temple. Sitting out here watching the traffic wasn't getting her any closer to the answers she needed. Or even any closer to knowing whether there were any. Monday, April 20th. MV Mirai. At sea, somewhere northwest of Kyoshi Island. When he'd planned this trip back to what he jokingly called the real world, Corwin had optimistically estimated that he'd be gone for 3 days, one for each of the linked but separate Turing evaluation hearings he'd been summoned as a witness for, plus one for incidentals. He might, with a little luck, even make it back before the Mirai reached Kyoshi Island. In the event, his estimate turned out to be very optimistic, because the evaluations bogged down almost immediately into exactly the sort of grinding technical death march he had, on some level, been afraid they would turn into. With the first of a brand new class of highly advanced robots, and the first example of an old and not very advanced class ever to seek certification before them, the Turing Board were taking absolutely nothing on faith. They were going back to first principles on everything, and Corwin, to his colossal frustration, could only play their game. He kept in regular contact with his family all the while, at first by making lens contact with either Ujna or Korra, now that the Transveil relay was on the network. That allowed only second-level contact with anyone else, though, and by the third night he decided it simply wouldn't do. The Mirai was a few hours out of Port Suki, having delivered Maki back to the island in good time. The sun had just set, and the western sky was still a blaze of orange and pink, filling the solarium with soft colors. Korra sat at the design desk, tinkering in a desultory sort of way with one of the diagrams. Minami, sitting in her armchair by the door, recognized the look of a person trying to make work for herself and chuckled. Ryo's latest report indicated that everything was proceeding very well at the job site. Between that and Corwin being gone, she expected that Korra had more or less run out of things to do by this point. Any moment now, she might even admit it to herself. At the sound of her soft chuckle, Ujna glanced over from the futon with a questioning look. Minami was about to explain when Korra's gearphone rang, startling everyone in the room slightly. Well, Annabelle didn't seem to care. Korra pushed herself away from the design desk and got the phone out, regarding it with something slightly like dread. Most of the reasons she could think of for a phone call out of the blue at this hour were not good ones. She'd been lucky so far on this trip, indeed, in this spring so far, generally, and no major crisis had arisen that needed her urgent attention, but perhaps her luck had just run out. Sighing, she opened the phone and raised it to her ear. Hello? Hey, Cora, it's me. Corwin's voice replied, sounding tired but pleased to hear her. She blinked. Corwin? Are you back in Dicho? Why didn't you just come to the Mirai? No, I'm still on Turing 3, said Corwin wearily. Cora took the phone away from her head to regard it with a look of puzzlement, then put it back and asked, Then how are you calling this phone? I don't have a cross-veil calling plan on my mobile. Hi, Norse god, good with tools, Corwin said conversationally. Cora laughed. Okay, fair point, she said. I bet you want to talk to Anthy. Or Minami, but I have a harder time picturing that. She added with a playfully pointed look at the latter. Minami stuck her tongue out. I will be happy to talk to anyone and everyone, Corwin said, so long as they aren't members of the Turing Board. Perhaps I should start with the mother of my present as opposed to future child, however. Seniority. Oh, for... don't you start, too, said Cora. Sorry, was that my outside voice? Corwin asked. Tired. Filters down for maintenance. Anthy, please. Right. Hang on. She lowered the phone, got down from her stool, and crossed to offer it to Anthy. Corwin, for you, she said, and then added with a wink, He's in a very you mood. Don't encourage him. Why ever would you think I would do such a thing? Anthy inquired innocently, taking the phone. Hello, dear. We're just talking about you. Do you guys not have phones of your own? Minami asked Uchina, looking surprised. Nope, Uchina replied, shaking her head. Corwin's got his Omni-tool, and we've mostly been on Air Temple Island since we came to Dicho, with landlines right handy. Guess we didn't think of it. Well, that won't do, said Minami with a grin. Remind me in the morning and I'll hook you up, or at least Anthy. Otherwise, Corwin won't be able to reach her if Cora's wandered off someplace. She does that sometimes, she added with a sly wink. Short attention span. I can hear you, you know, Cora remarked without looking away from the design desk's screen. Later that night, Cora found herself changing up her game a little bit, just for variety's sake. Instead of heading down to the flight deck to do her usual evening workout before bed, she went up to the front of the ship, as far forward as it was possible to go before the small foredeck came to a point. In the militarized production version of the Mirai class, there was a gun turret here. The catalog offered a range of different types based on how the ship's operators planned to crew them. Minami had dispensed with such an item on her yacht and extended the railing around the foredeck out to where it would be, replacing the turret itself with a further expanse of flat, rubberized deck plating. In doing so, she had, perhaps without meaning to, created a perfect spot for a person to sit and do a little meditating, at least if that person didn't mind meditating in a 45-knot headwind. Cora didn't. In fact, she rather preferred it to complete calm, which she tended to find a little oppressive, and so the Forked Peak had become one of her favorite places aboard the ship. If truth were told, she wasn't really meditating in any sense that her teachers of old would have accepted as such. To old conventionalists like Tenzin the Elder, meditation meant clearing the mind, reducing it to an empty stillness, or as close as one could get. But empty stillness wasn't in Cora's nature. She was a water spirit, and still water is dead water. When she sat someplace with her eyes closed, unmoving, and wasn't just asleep, what she was nearly always really doing was having a quiet think about something. Exactly the opposite of meditation as customarily understood. Uchina and Anthy found her there half an hour or so later, when they emerged from the hatch leading out onto the foredeck from the compartment below the bridge. Spotting the familiar figure sitting out at the point of the deck in the dark, Utna nearly called out to her, something along the lines of, "There you are!" until she realized they had barged into quiet time and tried to make a discreet withdrawal instead. Before they could do that, Cora turned without rising and looked back over her shoulder. They could see her eyes glint in the moonlight, followed a moment later by her teeth as she smiled at the sight of them. "Hey, guys," she said, raising a hand. "Come on out. It's a nice night."
"We didn't mean to interrupt your meditation," said Anthe as she and Uchna made their way forward to join her.
"Spiritual tranquility is overrated," said Cora casually, hitching herself around to face aft. Utna and Anthe seated themselves side by side, facing her and each other, to make a little triangular grouping. Despite the fact that they were nearing the equator again, it was a slightly chilly night, at least when the Mirai's speed was taken into account. Utna, as ever, didn't seem to care about that, but Anthe had prudently broken out her water tribe Amautik. Although, as the Rose Priestess settled herself into Seiza, Cora noticed that its pocket was empty.
"Where's Annabelle?" she wondered.
"Minami is looking after her for a while," said Anthe with a smile. "Or helping Garnet look after her, as I'm sure Garnet would prefer we put it," Utna added.
"You guys want to be careful with that," Cora warned. At the puzzled look this drew from both of them, she went on with a wry smile.
"The more time Minami spends with Annabelle, the more it's going to make her think about her own plans."
"Ah, so she's not joking about wanting to have Corwin's babies?" said Utna.
Her tone was light, even mischievous. She seemed neither surprised nor particularly concerned by the idea.
"Oh, she is," Cora assured her. "But someday she may well not be anymore. You have to understand, that's how the women in that family have always operated. Minami and Ryo's parents have been the exception so far. Their father didn't have a father of record, and neither did his mother or her mother."
She smiled wryly.
"The Sato women are an independent bunch, but they care about their posterity. It's not anything you have to worry about right now. She's not ready for motherhood yet, and she wouldn't go there without your permission. But one of these days, I'm pretty sure you are going to get that call."
"Well," said Anthe, so mildly that it wasn't immediately obvious whether she was joking, "I'm certainly in no position to be scandalized by the idea." Utna chuckled.
"Yeah, seriously," she said. "As for me, well, I mean, it'd be okay with me if they did it the sciencey way, unlike Nature Priestess over here," she added wryly. "But I can't fault her for being interested in picking up some quality genes."
"You actually mean that, don't you?" said Cora, giving the two women a faintly amazed look.
"You guys are really something."
"Thank you," said Anthe modestly. "We try."
"And speaking of sharing Corwin," Utna began, and Anthe, her serene composure almost audibly fracturing, turned and gave her a look best described as a silent cry of, "Seriously?"
"What?"
Utna asked, shrugging. Then, turning back to the startled-looking avatar, she went on in what Cora felt was a weirdly conversational tone.
"It's just that Anthe and I have noticed recently that things seem to be changing between you and Corwin, and we're a little worried about where it looks like it's headed."
Anthe actually dropped her forehead into her hand at that, which would have struck Cora as very funny if she hadn't been so mortified. Utna could see Cora's face going red even in the dim moonlight and sighed, exasperated at herself now.
"That didn't come out right," she grumbled before Anthe could point it out.
Reaching out, she forestalled any reply by seizing the Avatar's hands and pulling them toward her.
"We're worried about you, Cora," she said earnestly.
Huh? Said Cora, surprised enough to abandon the half-formed I would never that she'd been working on. Come on, it's me, Utrinna added wryly. You ought to know by now that if I was ticked about something, I'd have just come up here and started a fight. What I'm trying to do is put your mind at ease. Your mind and your heart, Anthy put in, moving nearer to add her own hands to the clasp. We've seen how self-conscious you're becoming about your affection for him, and we don't want that. It can lead to nothing but confusion and pain. Corwin will notice you pulling away from him sooner or later, and he might not know how to read it. And it's perfectly unnecessary, I promise you. The bond you two share is beautiful to us, and we don't care what anyone else thinks it looks like. With a mildly reproachful smile, she added, I would have thought you'd have realized that about us by now. Cora hesitated, looking as if she were caught in a corner between pleased and dismayed. I don't know what to say. Remember what you told me when I had my little meltdown? Utrinna asked. Say what you want to say, however you want to say it. You can say anything to us. Cora raised an eyebrow slightly. Anything? She said, and something in her tone was almost a warning. Anything, Anthy agreed, gently squeezing her hands. Cora looked from one of them to the other for a few seconds, then let out a long, slow breath. Okay, look. A big part of it is appearances. I'm a very physical person, you've probably noticed, she added wryly, drawing smiling nods from both Tenjos. Some of my predecessors as Avatar were so spiritual as to almost transcend material reality, but I'm not one of them. Half smiling in spite of herself at a memory, she added, Someone I met early in my career once told Master Tenzin that I'd had a hard time getting a handle on the spiritual part of my job because I was, and I quote, too busy having, and enjoying the various uses of, a body. Ha ha, right on, said Utrinna, grinning. I did eventually get the spirit thing working, Cora went on, but I'm still pretty fond of having a body. And, well, that makes me very tactile. I'm not an arm's-length kind of girl, especially about things and people I like. Normally that isn't a problem, but sometimes it can be misunderstood. You saw that firsthand with that business with the Tribune, which, well, we sorted it out, but it got me thinking, and once I start thinking, sometimes it's hard to stop. You remember what Kate said at lunch when the Trib thing finally broke open? If you had been on a date, it would have looked exactly the same. I keep thinking about that, because she was totally right. That's okay, though, said Utrinna earnestly. That's what we're trying to tell you. Cora nodded. I know, and I really appreciate it. Honestly, I do. But it's not entirely... She trailed off, her face closing down, and looked away. Utrinna waited for her to go on with her thought. It didn't happen. After a few silent seconds, she let go of Cora's hands with one of hers, reached up, and gently touched her cheek instead, asking in a low, caring voice, What's wrong? Cora hesitated again, looking into her eyes, then lowered her own and confessed in a tone that was starkly unlike her usual one. I'm afraid. Of what? Said Anthy. Of this, Cora replied. Of even having this conversation. Raising her eyes to theirs again, she went on in a slight rush. I'm afraid if I even acknowledge that I know what you're talking about, it's all going to go horribly wrong. Anthy made a soft sound of concern and squeezed their linked hands.
"That's what we're trying to tell you, Angiuvuk. You need never fear speaking plainly with us."
Cora blinked, surprised. She hadn't realized Anthy knew any Tukisi, so to be addressed by her as our sister in it was startling, and then shook her head, looking down at the deck.
"About something like this, I'm not even sure I dare speak plainly with myself."
"Oh, I get it," said Utna with a nod. "You're kind of freaked out, because you've known the boy his whole life, and now sometimes you catch yourself thinking, 'Oh, hello.'"
Cora looked up, too startled to guard her reaction, and blurted,
"How did you—"
before she could catch herself. Utina's expression wasn't the malicious grin of a jealous woman who has just caught out a rival. Instead, it was a comradely smile, almost a sisterly one, as of one discovering that a new friend shares one of her most passionate interests.
"You know the old saying," she said cheerfully. "Takes one to know one. I've been bumping into that door for years. Doesn't bother me that I'm not the only one."
She grinned. "It's another thing we have in common."
"It's so weird, though," Cora protested.
"Is it?" Anthy wondered. Cora gave her an are-you-kidding-me look, booted out of her moment of unaccustomed fear by their feigned obtuseness.
Yeah, she said. "You know full well it is. Because Utrin is right. I've known Corwin his whole life. Literally his whole life. I mean—"
She removed her hands gently from theirs and held them up, regarding them in the moonlight.
"I mean, these hands were the first ones that ever touched him."
She looked up from her hands to Utrina's eyes.
"You don't ever get over that," she said seriously. "It leaves a mark that never goes away, and you don't want it to go away. I wouldn't trade it for anything. But it colors everything that comes after it. I would never take advantage, but it's just, I catch myself noticing him, and it makes me feel strange."
She sighed, puffing her cheeks.
"So what you've been seeing, that wasn't only me not wanting to hurt your feelings. It was also me not knowing what to do with my own."
Utrina nodded.
"I understand. Believe it or not, I've had a taste or two of that myself from time to time. I'm only a year and a half older than he is, but when we first met, it was a really significant year and a half. I was a few days short of my 15th birthday, and for reasons we don't need to get into right now, I was a very mature 15 in terms of my life experiences."
At this, Anthy silently reached between them and placed a hand on Utrina's folded left leg, just above the knee, bowing her head a little sadly. Utrina gave her a small, thankful smile, leaving Cora to marvel at their powers of silent communication, and went on, "The situation was a little different, I grant you, because Corwin fell hard for me almost instantly, but it took me months to realize it. I said I was mature. I never said I was particularly perceptive." She added wryly, leavening the moment a little. "Anyway, my point is, he was still really just a boy when that happened, and I was already almost a woman, in some ways. So I felt all kinds of weird about it when I found that I was starting to feel a more than friendly attraction to him myself. I can only imagine how much more intense and strange that must be for you, but I think I kind of know what it tastes like." Cora nodded, but didn't interject, sensing that there was more to Utrina's point. An impression that was confirmed a moment later, when the Rose Prince took a breath and continued, "But I'll tell you what didn't help, and that was denying it. Holding it down and hoping it would go away. Letting it stop me from just being honest and acting natural. That didn't help.
It didn't help for the rest of that year. And it didn't help for almost 4 years after he managed to bring Anthy and me back together again. I thought I was doing the right thing. We both did. But all we were really doing was hurting each other. And ourselves, and even Anthy, in a way. Cora, said Anthy kindly, we realize that, simply because of your position in this world, you're not always completely free. We would relieve you of one small part of that burden, because we love and trust you. You're part of our family, our beloved's oldest friend, our sister in word and bond, our only child, Saunik. If Cora had been surprised that Anthy knew Angiuvuk, she was genuinely shocked, mostly in a good way, that she knew the word Saunik. Literally the Tukisi word for bone, in the context of family it conveyed all the vast depth of meaning in Cora's relation to Annabel Cora Tenjo and her parents that the pale, technical, Anglo-standard word namesake couldn't carry. That Anthy would invoke it now revealed something of not only the extent to which she'd studied the ways of Water Tribe family life, but also the strength of her belief in what she was saying. And Utina, by her side, was unwavering in her silent, for the moment, concurrence with all the Rose Priestess said. You must never feel constrained with any of us, Anthy went on, looking Cora straight in the eye. Especially not Corwin, Utina put in. Anthy nodded agreement, leaning forward, and embraced the Avatar. After a moment, Utina joined in, murmuring, We haven't brought him back into your life just to force you apart. Cora blinked several times, both in an effort to bring everything she was being told on board, and to clear her eyes of the tears that threatened to well up in them at the intensity of this completely unexpected conversation. For a few seconds, through the group hug and out the other side as they all resumed their seats in their little triangular group, no one spoke. At length, Cora chuckled wryly and said, The funny thing is, it's kind of a moot point anyway. Like I told Emily, homewrecking's not my game. You couldn't wreck our home, you're part of it, Utina said positively. Besides, we're not talking about outcomes here, just being open to possibilities. Anthy nodded agreement. This is about love and trust and communication. You'll never be able to resolve your other concerns if you're not able to go forward with an open heart. They'll only fester and grow ever more confused. So, let go, Cora. Be free. Be happy. Be at ease. Embrace your feelings, whatever they are or may evolve into, and don't be afraid to show them. What do you care what other people think? Utina added with a snarky grin, banking on either Corwin or Griffin, sometime in the last 19 years, having given her the background for the reference. Evidently one of them had, because at that, Cora laughed, feeling all the dismay and trepidation that had been surging inside her throughout the conversation flow out of her and into the cool night air. Then, once it had gone and left her feeling clean and a little bit empty, she sat looking up at the riot of stars in the sky for a moment, her eyes automatically picking out the familiar equatorial constellations. The dragon, the great and lesser platypus bears, Hue the Hunter. With a sigh that was equal parts relief and resignation, she got to her feet, reached down to help both of the Tenjos up, and headed with them back into the ship. They said nothing until they reached the companionway leading up to the bridge tower and down to the guest quarters. I'm gonna have to do a lot more thinking about this, Cora said. But thanks, you guys. She searched for the words. I really appreciate that you care enough to haul everything into the open.
However shocked I still am that you did it, she added.
Utna smiled. Hey, it was my turn, she said easily. Remember when I told you about whatever's bothering you, bring it to me?
Cora nodded.
Utna hugged her and went on. Well, what I didn't mention at the time is that the level above that is whatever's bothering you, I'll bring it to you.
Cora chuckled, hugging her back, and was mildly surprised to be kissed on the cheek before they parted. Just before they all went their separate ways, it occurred to her to ask,
By the way, has anyone actually asked Corwin what he thinks at any point?
Not yet, Anthy replied. Then, with a slightly evil grin, she added, I thought we might just wait and see how long it takes him to notice.
Please note, not my plan, Utna put in.
In the meantime, said Anthy, relax and be yourself. When Corwin comes back, if the fancy takes you to touch him, just touch him. Hug him, kiss him, jump on his back, steal his clothes and wear them yourself. I've done that. It's quite good fun, she remarked with an emerald wink. Whatever your heart calls on you to do.
Giving the Avatar a hug and kiss of her own, she added quietly, Among honest hearts and open minds, the rest will look after itself.
Thank you, Cora murmured.
You're welcome, Angyuvuk, said Anthy. And she and Utna went below.
Cora stood at the base of the bridge tower stairs for a moment, looking at where they had just been, and then went not down to her own quarters, but upstairs to the solarium. She wanted to be up high and close to the open tonight. Neri, sprawled in the middle of the floor and snoring much more gently than a beast of her size could reasonably be expected to snore, didn't wake when she arrived. Cora smiled at the sight, took off her boots and trousers, and climbed into the futon, then arranged herself not for sleep, but further contemplation.
Sunday, April 25th. Air Temple Island, Republic City. The Mirai docked in Future City on Saturday night, late enough that the Air Temple was mostly asleep when Cora and the Tenjos finally made it to the island. After unloading their things from the Agni 6 with Minami's help, packing her off back to the city in her own bed, and then carrying everything up the hill with Neri's uncomplaining assistance, they all went straight to bed. Cora didn't even have the energy to go back down to her own room in the ladies' quarters, or perhaps she simply didn't want to, and crashed on the futon in the project office instead. By the time they rose the next day, they'd missed breakfast with the airbenders, but that was no great hardship. Utna simply dusted off her pancaking skills, which had lain idle for most of her Dicho vacation, and went to work. Within 10 minutes, all three women, Garnet and Makoto, were enjoying some fine quickbread products and fruits, while the ones who had powers of speech exercised them cheerfully. It was exactly the kind of morning Cora preferred, late rising, low pressure, convivial, and pancake-equipped. It reminded her fondly of happy mornings on Crescent Island at the height of the preparations for Phoenix flight. Now that she was back on the island, and back in springtime in the northern hemisphere, Anthy had reluctantly closeted her Amautik and gone back to her modified air nomad style of crimson tunic and robe. Which wasn't to say she minded that style, far from it. But she had to admit the Water Tribe garment was a lot simpler than lashing Annabelle to her back or chest with her airbender sash. For her part, Annabelle didn't seem to care one way or the other. Assuming she was clean and well-fed, she would repose happily in whatever enclosure she was put in, so long as at least one of her parents, one of the other adults on her preferred persons list, and/or Garnet, was close by. So Jury looks the guy right in the eye and says, Laugh? I nearly bought one, Utna said.
They were all still laughing. Garnet wasn't even sure what at, since she didn't know Juri, but Utina's delivery had sold it anyway. When they heard a door open at the far end of the hall and a familiar voice call, "Hello? Anybody home? Don't tell me you're all still at sea or something."
"Did you hear that, Annabelle?" Enthi asked the infant, smiling. "Your father's home at last."
Utina leaned toward the archway to the hall and shouted, "Kitchen!" Corwin arrived in the doorway a moment later, still, or, well, more likely, again, wearing his good suit and looking a bit tired, but reasonably pleased with the outcome of his expedition. "Hey, here are all my favorite ladies together in one room," he remarked as he entered. "How lucky can one guy get?"
"Don't let your mother hear you say that," Utina quipped.
"Hungry? Pancakes?"
"No, thanks," Corwin replied. "It's late afternoon for me. I hit the Johnny Rockets in the Turing Institute's food court before I left. Also, just for the record, if Mom had been here to hear me say that, problem solves itself."
Rising from her seat, Cora laughed and went to give him a hug. This was the first test of her new stop-filtering-yourself policy, and she had to apply all her clear-your-mind training, unevenly absorbed at the best of times, she had to admit, to stop herself from thinking self-consciously about it, as she hugged him and said, "Welcome back," before impulsively kissing him on the cheek.
"Oh, come on, you call that a welcome back kiss?" said Utina, shouldering her out of the way.
"Like this," she added, then embraced her husband and gave him a good old-fashioned thanks-for-showing-me-the-world-engine kiss. It wasn't an especially erotic kiss, certainly not one of those prelude-to-buttons-being-torn-off ones, but it was passionate and tender, and delivered a definite message that she was very pleased to see him. When it was finished, she looked Corwin in the eye, gave him a mischievous little smile he couldn't figure out how to read, and then stepped aside, gestured to Cora, and said, "Now you try." In the space of a few milliseconds, Cora's expression went from startled to faintly dismayed to peculiarly determined. With an instant's challenging glance at Utina, "Don't think I'll do it, do you?" She stepped forward, seized the lapels of Corwin's suit jacket, and planted a proper smooch of her own on him as his eyes went wide with surprise. Hers was a little fiercer, on Utina's personal kiss reference scale, more of a thanks for rescuing me from Worcester, but not rough by any means, and there was a distinct note of warmth in it. All in all, quite a respectable effort for the spur of the moment. Utina and Anthy made impressed eye contact, then turned back to observe.
"Gosh, she learns fast," Utina mused.
"Hmm," said Anthy with a sage nod, photographing the scene with the phone Minami had given her. "The lapel grab is quite an advanced technique." After a couple of seconds, Cora turned him loose and stepped back, grinning a little guiltily at his blankly astonished face.
"Was that weird?" she asked, slightly breathless.
Corwin blinked slowly at her, as if taking longer than normal to parse the question. Then, in a matter-of-fact sort of voice, he replied,
"Yes. Yes, it was."
"Good weird or bad weird?" Cora wondered, looking wary. He worked on that one for even longer, a full 2 or 3 seconds, and then replied,
"Reply hazy, try again," in a note of near-complete bafflement.
"No fair, that wasn't a yes or no question," Utina muttered to Anthy, who giggled.
"Don't mind if I..." Cora began with a sly little grin, but then her gear phone rang, forestalling the rest of her remark. Scowling, she muttered,
"Seriously?"
as she hauled it out to check the caller ID.
With a soft growl, she flipped it open, raised it to her ear, and snapped without preamble, "I'm right in the middle of something, Ray!" The reply was inaudible to anyone else in the room except as a sort of tinny scratching noise, but even that was enough to give the impression that the caller was very agitated, an impression Cora reinforced a moment later by saying in a less annoyed tone, "Whoa, whoa, slow down, Ray, deep breaths. Daisuke did what?" "Well, what did he figure he was going to accomplish with that?" "No, no, rhetorical question. Okay, I'm on my way. Tell Eitaro to meet me there with my spare gear. I don't have time to suit up here." "Yeah. Bye." Closing the phone with a sigh, she looked around the kitchen, then said, "I gotta go. Task force trouble." "Anything we can help with?" Utena asked, but Cora shook her head. "Nah, I think we can handle it," she said. "Just the squad's token firebender having another of his brilliant plans." She rolled her eyes. "I don't like to seem like I'm profiling, but sometimes it really does feel like those guys all came from the same factory. Anyway, gotta run. Eitaro's waiting." With a hard-to-read little smile, she leaned and kissed Corwin again, the gesture much quicker, but by no means perfunctory. Then she told him, "We'll get back to this later," turned, and hustled off down the hall. "Looking forward to it?" he said, at around the same time that the front door banged shut behind her. He stood blinking bemusedly off down the hall for a second, then turned to Utena and Anthy. "What just happened?" he asked. "Dang," said Garnet, as she uncoiled from Annabelle's wrap and sprang to Utrina's shoulder. "That girl's easier to play than an auto harp." "If you know the right buttons to press," Anthy agreed. "You're a 6-week-old dragon. How do you even know what an auto harp is?" Utrina wondered. Garnet drew herself up with miniature offended dignity. "I'll have you know I come from a very musical lineage. My uncle invented the erhu." "Right," said Utrina, in a deliberately unconvincing, "so that's it" voice. "Hi, deeply confused husband on line one," Corwin tried again. "Why don't you two go for a walk?" Anthe suggested. "Annabelle and I have some business to attend to." "Nap time," Garnet declared, darting back to her station in Annabelle's wrap. "It's always nap time with you," Utena said, rolling her eyes. "Come on, Makoto, we'll take Mr. Boomerang." They walked out to the cliffside perch, where Utena had spent an evening some weeks before, sat down about where she and Cora had been at the time, and he threw the boomerang for the flying lemur to chase while Utena tried to explain certain developments. She was about halfway through recounting the curious conversation she, Anthy, and Cora had had on Monday night, after his first phone call from Turing, when she was interrupted by what sounded like a roll of distant thunder. Pausing, she looked around and saw no evidence of anything other than a lovely sunny day in progress. Blue sky and fluffy white clouds as far as the eye could see in all directions. "Did you hear that?" Utena asked. Corwin gazed off toward the Republic City skyline to the northeast, his face in a curious, thoughtful frown. "Yeah," he said. "Thunder, you think? I don't see any signs, but..." She chuckled. "It doesn't seem likely that someone's shelling Republic City." "I'm not sure. I thought I heard," Corwin murmured, his voice trailing off. Then, shaking his head, he said, "You're probably right. Anyway, go on. I remain mightily confused." He was still confused a few minutes later, when another unexpected sound interrupted Uchina's narrative. This one was much closer to hand, and almost instantly recognizable. The sound of an infant crying, coming to them on the breeze from the direction of the house. Even if they hadn't recognized Annabelle's voice, she was the only baby on the island right now. For a second, Utna and Corwin almost filed it as normal, and went on with what they were doing. Annabelle was a very quiet baby, but even so, it wasn't in any way startling or unusual for her to cry, for the same reasons any six-week-old did. It was a generic master caution alarm, indicating anything from "I require immediate maintenance" to "I cannot reach the object I have just decided I must touch immediately," to virtually any other routine state of affairs in between. Anthea and Garnet were with her, and well able to handle any such routine fault. A moment later, that assumption was dashed to bits as the sound of Annabelle's crying changed, ramping up in both frequency and amplitude to become an outright banshee wail. This was no ordinary alarm. It reached deep into the mammalian brains of its hearers and flicked an ancient switch, causing an instant and involuntary surge of adrenaline. Corwin and Utna bolted to their feet, 2 billion years of evolution priming them to fight or flee at the sound of their offspring in serious distress. They glanced at each other, confirmed that they both were hearing it, and then took off for the house at full pelt, shouting for Makoto to follow them. By the time they emerged from the bamboo thicket next to the house and into the courtyard, the sound had attracted a few passers-by as well. Lokpa and Nima were both among them, the former pushing her way through the small crowd of air acolytes that was gathering, the latter slipping gracefully between and around them to arrive in the clear ahead of her sister. "What is it?" Lokpa inquired, real dismay on her face. "What's wrong?" "How should I know? I'm still out here," Corwin snapped, dashing past her. The two airbender sisters shared a look. "He's got a point," Nima seemed to be saying, and then followed him and Utna into the house. The four of them burst together into the front room to find Anthea holding Annabelle close, trying to soothe her, and the child not having any of it. Even the arrival of her two dads, as Utrina sometimes half-jokingly classified herself and Corwin, and Nima, one of her favorite people, couldn't entirely quell her cries. Though they did at least ramp down from a continual shriek of anguish to fitful wails of intense misery. "What's the matter?" Utrina asked. "Is she hurt?" Anthea shook her head. "No," she said. "She's fine. It's just Garnet's disappeared." Utna blinked at her. "What do you mean, disappeared?" "Exactly what I said," Anthea replied, more than a little sharply. Her daughter's distress hadn't exactly rattled her, but it had clearly placed her on edge. "She disappeared. One moment she was with us, curled up in the usual way. The next, she was gone. Annabelle was asleep, but when she woke up and found Garnet gone, well, you heard." "Did you hear a sound like far-off thunder when it happened?" Corwin asked, before anyone else could offer a follow-up. Anthea looked slightly surprised. "Yes," she said. "Corwin, do you know?" Corwin's face darkened to a scowl, his big fists involuntarily closing. "Nall," he growled. "What the hell are you playing at?" "What's Nall got to do with it?" Lokpa demanded. Corwin shot her a "do not you start with me" glare, then turned back to Utna and Anthea and said, "Dragons have this thing they do, an ancient form of magic that's tied up with their language. One of the tricks they can do with it is summoning another dragon whose name they know." "You're saying you think Nall kidnapped your daughter's dragon?" Lokpa burst out. "I can't think of any other who would know her name," he replied, his voice tightly controlled. "He was there when she told it to Annabelle." "Why would he do that?" Nima wondered. Before Corwin or Utna could voice the reply that crossed their minds at the same moment,
Lokba surprised them both by doing it for them.
I don't know, but I'm damn well going to find out.
Then, turning, she marched angrily toward the door, snapping back over her shoulder.
Come on, you three. Nima, we're going to need Vayu.
I'm on it, Nima replied instantly, fishing her bison whistle out of her tunic as the sisters, suddenly and unconsciously welded back into a team, left the room together.
Unexpected, Corwin observed, startled out of his fury for a moment. Then he turned to Anthy.
Will you be okay if we...
Anthy nodded.
Go, she said. I'll tend to Annabelle. She's in no real danger, except possibly of a broken heart, she added with a tender, sad look, smoothing her still inconsolable daughter's tousled violet hair.
We'll be back as soon as we can, Corwin promised, kissing first the baby, then her mother, and turning to go.
And we'll bring Garnet with us, Utina added, repeating both operations.
When Corwin and Utina reached the courtyard, they were surprised and a bit annoyed to find that Nima and Lokba hadn't made it any farther than that. They both seemed to have gotten distracted by something. They were standing there, staring off to the northeast, their faces slack with something that looked very like shock.
What? Utina asked. What's the problem?
Lokba raised a slightly trembling hand and pointed.
Look.
Corwin and Utina turned to look, then blinked in surprise and stood rooted themselves, unable to do anything but look for a moment.